dreamy and meaningful life is the right for each of us. All of us have the power to not only experience lots of desired moments, but also create more effective time in our life. To create your dreamy life, you must light the dark path ahead with the light of time wisdom to step into your dreamy world. Here, I am to dedicate sharing time wisdom from the genius writers, the best mindset leaders and coaches, and also highly effective people around the world. My name is Iman Abrishamchi, the founder of Time Coach and the host of Brain Time Podcast. We do believe the real time management is about pain, mindset, energy and perspective management. And all people around the world are enabled to have the best time only if they learn how to do it. In Brain Time Podcast series, we reveal effective strategies and hidden tricks to help people to learn time wisdom and create effective time. You can also download Time Coach application in iOS and Android platform by just searching your Time Coach. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Nir, thank you for accepting my invitation to the second, talk that we have had, up to now. And it was last conversation was awesome. Created a lot of wisdom in many people over here, and they asked me a lot, "Oh, Iman, what should we do with this crazy thing? It's distraction and I cannot do anything about it and these sort of thing." And it comes to my mind that second person that I have to talk, especially in Brain Time Podcast, is Nir Eyal with the genius book of Indistractable. So, first of all, how are you? How are things with you? How is everything? You seem really busy these days. Yeah,
I am pretty busy, but it's fun. It's great. The book has had a really great impact, and I thought the world was distracting before COVID. And then when I wrote the book, it came out late 2019. I thought the world was plenty distracting then. And it's only become more distracting. So I'm so glad that I have the book for myself to help me stay focused on what's important. And I think other people have found it also very, very helpful in this very distracting time.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Oh, so I will ask one personal question from the first scratch. You cannot answer. Okay.
You're making me nervous here.
Acceptable. You should answer it. Okay. What was your distraction during the COVID-19 era?
The news.
Yes.
The news.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, between COVID and the American elections and, Trump said this and that happened and the violence and the, oh my God, there's so much happening in the world. And I think what's tricky about it is that, it's important to know what's going on, but I think it's oftentimes difficult to understand when you've had enough, when it's not serving you, you are serving it. That we have to remember, the news is a business, right? I don't care whether you get your news from, CNN or Fox or Facebook. It doesn't matter. They all make money the same way. They sell your attention. And it's not that the news is a bad thing. It's that we need to make sure that it is serving us as opposed to us serving it. And I think, that for me was quite difficult, that I needed to reassess and, look at my Indistractable model often to make sure that I wasn't going overboard.
Okay, fantastic. Nir, you have told me previously that your book, Indistractable, is mastering the skill of the century. At that time, to be honest, at that time, I was a little bit skeptic about this code, this century, something like this. And after COVID-19 happened, I was okay, Nir was right.
I'm sorry about judging you about it. Could you please elaborate it a little more, you know, especially for people who are really looking forward to see what should they do in their lives?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. This is why I call it the skill of the century, because there is no area of your life that does not depend on your ability to control your attention, right? That how do you live healthfully, right? How do you make sure that you eat right and exercise and take care of your physical health? How do you make sure that you take care of your emotional health, your psychological health, your relationships, of course, your work? All of these things depend on your ability to do whatever it is you say you're going to do. So I'm not here to tell you what you should do, right? I'm not here to tell you what your values are. Whatever your values are, whatever's important to you in your life is up to you. Only you can decide that. And you should think for yourself and decide how you want to spend your time and your life. But what I want to help you do is, once you know that, and I walk you through in the book how to decide what's important to you, what are your values, I want to help you live out those values, because I think it's such a monumental waste of life and human capital and the ability to improve the world when people wake up one day and they say, what did I do this month? How did I move my life forward? What did I do this year? How did I move my life forward? What did I do this lifetime?
Yeah.
To live the kind of life that I wanted to live. And it goes by like that. You know, I'm 42 years old. It's incredible how quickly the years start going by the older you get. And if we don't take time to say, wait a minute, what do I actually want to do with my time on earth? How do I make sure that I get the most out of this very brief period that I have here on this planet? If you don't do that and decide with intent how you spend every minute of your day, other people are going to influence you. Right? The media companies, your friends, your boss, your kids, everything in your life is going to pull you towards what they want you to do with your time as opposed to how you want to spend your time. So that's why I think it's the skill of the century.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So I will go ahead with some words and you just let me know what's in your mind. First of all, akrasia.
Akrasia. So akrasia is the tendency to do things against our better interest. And so yeah. This is the ancient Greek term. Plato talked about it. It's our tendency to do things against our better interest. And I talk about it in the book as evidence that this is not a new problem, that people think that distraction is caused by technology as if that's something new. It's not new. People have always been distracted by one thing or the other. That if Plato was distracted 2,500 years before the iPhone, it tells us that it's something deeper about our state of being. It's part of the human condition.
So if someone calls you and tell you, okay, I have some, you know, internal triggers and external triggers, and he knows everything about it. He knows everything about your book, Distraction Traction. External trigger, internal trigger, and everything. And he told you, okay, I cannot do anything about it. What's your suggestion?
My suggestion is to change the narrative.
Uh-huh.
That if you believe there's nothing you can do about it, it's true. It's true. You've already decided. You're absolutely right.
Yes.
So this is where we have to change the narrative. And I talk about this in the book around how we have to reimagine our temperament. Our temperament is our conception of our indelible traits. And so when people think to themselves, I have an addictive personality, or I have a short attention span, or I can't do this, or I'm this kind of person, it's true.
Yes.
And so we have to be comfortable with changing that narrative, that one of the most dangerous things that people do is to tell themselves stories about themselves that don't serve them. How many stories do we have to tell about ourselves that we are a certain way? It's bullshit. It is utter bullshit. You don't have to be anything that you don't want to be. So don't put that on you. It's not a physical trait. Your personality is not something that can never change. We're seeing that actually people have a lot of flexibility in terms of the kind of person they are. There's only, you know, we don't have to get into the psychology of it, but it turns out that most of these self-defining traits that people live their life according to are really damaging, are very, very harmful. So that's where I would start. If you say, I can't do this. Well, then of course you can't. Okay. It's about trying. It's about being flexible with, hey, let me give it a shot.
Yes. Inner dialogue play an important role in everything. All aspects of life. Especially these days that we are all alone with ourselves, with, you know, everything is now down, and that's something like helpful. Yeah. And Nir, my dear, if I would like to ask you a very important question, especially about these days, what is the most common inner trigger that people are facing these days?
Probably boredom. Uh-huh. I think that's probably been the most common internal trigger for all of human existence, is boredom. That, you know, there's been, I talk about these studies in the book where Timothy Wilson at Harvard did these studies where he put people in a room and he shocked their arm so that they could feel, you know, they put a strap around their arm. It wasn't harmful, but it was not comfortable. And then he said, I'm going to leave the room and I just want you to sit in this room until I come back. And he didn't tell them how long they would have to sit in the room. He just said, sit in this room until I come back. And this strap was on their arm with a little button that they could push to give themselves an electrical shock. 2/3 of men and 25% of women shock themselves because boredom, feeling something is better than being bored for a lot of people. That are many of our problems come from this inability to deal with discomfort. This is what distraction is all about. Distraction and procrastination. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. You're not deficient in some way. It's not a moral failing. It's simply that we haven't learned the tools, the techniques to deal with discomfort like boredom in a healthy way that leads us towards traction rather than distraction. So this is a skill that we learn.
How about fear?
Fear is certainly, I think fear, so fear has a lot of different flavors. Yeah. And I think the fear that I think is very palpable today is uncertainty. Uh-huh. So uncertainty is a type of fear. It's fear about the future. Mm-hmm. And I think we certainly see that today, right? Fear of what's going to happen with COVID, what's going to happen politically, what's going to happen economically. For many people, this is a very scary time.
Because we have talked to Patrick about especially FOBO and FOMO, and we especially talked about you a lot. You will find it out during the podcast. And we told each other, you know, I come up with the sentence that all human behavior is escape from a FOMO and FOBO, something like this. And for sure, this is really true. What happens to human, you know, where this sentence comes from, you know, all human behavior is escape from discomfort. For sure it is. And how can we, you know, explain this to, you know, to the listeners of this podcast? There is a discomfort and you are escaping from it. How help people face with discomfort?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that all human behavior is a desire to escape just those two forms of discomfort.
No, not just two. Yes, everything. Yes.
Yeah. So I think the fear of missing out is an internal trigger for sure. I think fear of best offer is also an internal trigger, but there are many, many, many internal triggers: boredom, uncertainty, fatigue, loneliness, lots and lots of uncomfortable emotional states. I think the best way to explain this is to realize that all human behavior, everything you do, is about a desire to escape discomfort. That if you think about it physiologically, so for our bodies, if you go outside and it's cold, the brain says, hey, this is not comfortable. This doesn't feel good. You should put on a jacket. If you walk back inside and now it's too hot, the brain says, oh, this doesn't feel good. Take your coat off. If you feel hunger pangs, the brain says, oh, that doesn't feel good. You should eat. And then if you eat too much, oh, you feel stuffed, you ate too much, the brain says, okay, stop eating. So physiologically, this is common sense. We all understand this. Everything you do physiologically, you do for the desire to escape discomfort. Even the pursuit of pleasurable sensations, wanting, craving, lusting, desire, all of these things are also psychologically destabilizing. It's also this discomfort of wanting. It's still discomfort. So physiologically, this is pretty obvious. Most people can understand this. The same holds true psychologically. So when you're feeling lonely, check Facebook.
Yeah.
When you're uncertain, Google. When you're bored, oh, lots of solutions for boredom. Watch sports, the stock market, Pinterest, Reddit, the news, right? If, instead of thinking about my own problems, let me worry about the problems of someone, you know, 1,000 miles away, right? So I don't have to worry about what's going on in my life. That is why we use these products and services. It is always about a desire to escape some kind of uncomfortable sensation. It's not only why we get distracted, it's why we do everything. Everything is a desire to escape discomfort.
Okay, fantastic. So at first I wanted to get the response for my questions. And now I will start the questions that might come to the listeners that have come across your book for the first time. So in your book, you have four strong ideas, you know, distraction, traction, internal trigger, and external triggers. So I appreciate if you could explain about these four elements, and then I will go ahead with each one and I will ask some questions about it.
Sure, so we have traction is the opposite of distraction. Traction is any action that pulls us towards what we say we're going to do. So things that help us live out our values and become the kind of person we want to become. So that's traction. The opposite of traction is distraction, any action that pulls us away from what we plan to do, anything that is not done with intent, anything that pulls us away from our values and away from the kind of person we want to become. Then we have internal triggers and external triggers that pull us towards traction and distraction. So external triggers are the pings, the dings, the rings, anything in our outside environment that can lead us towards traction, something we want to do, something that's done with intent, versus distraction, something that takes us away from what we plan to do. And then internal triggers are not outside of us, but they are originating from within. So this is what we just talked about around those uncomfortable emotional states, boredom, loneliness, fatigue, uncertainty, whatever it might be. Those are those uncomfortable sensations that we seek to escape from. Now, how we escape them, we can escape them in a thoughtful manner that moves us towards traction, or in a way that's an unhealthy way that leads us towards distraction. So now we have the four parts of the indistractable model. We have to master the internal triggers, that's step one. We have to make time for traction, that's step two. Hack back the external triggers is step three. And finally, prevent distraction with pacts. And it's these four methodologies in concert, this is how we become indistractable.
Fantastic, thank you. Nir, my dear, high expectation, low control. What is it?
Yeah, so this is a confluence of two factors that have been shown to cause depression and anxiety at work. Mm-hmm. So it's where, you know, if you think about what kind of work environment makes people depressed, like clinical depression.
Yeah.
When I first heard about this study, I would say, okay, well, what would I expect it to be before I knew the results of this study? I thought the kind of work that would make people depressed is a sad job, right? If you are a mortician, for example, or you have to work as a veterinarian and put down animals, I don't know, like a sad job, right? No, it's not about what you do. It's about the environment you do it in. That it's the confluence of these two conditions of high expectations coupled with low control. If you have those two things together, if you have high expectations and high control, you're fine. You can flourish. But if you have high expectations and yet a low ability to control those outcomes, this is the kind of work environment that leads to depression, anxiety disorder. It also leads to a lot of distraction because the worse people feel, the more of these depressive symptoms, right? Feelings of depression, anxiety feel bad. It's more of these internal triggers. What do? You look for escape. So when you think about these work environments where people are constantly distracted, they call meetings for, you know, no reason other than to hear the boss talk out loud and waste time. They send emails because, you know, in order to feel control and agency over something, let me send emails to people because that makes me feel in control of my work environment. So they look to compensate for a lack of control with all these behaviors that do nothing but distract other people.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Then, and this leads to your perfect code. Time management is pain management. Yes?
Exactly. Right. Right. Because all behaviors are about pain management. If all behavior is about a desire to escape discomfort, then, you know, if we focus on all the tips and tricks and life hacks and gurus techniques around how to manage our time, but we don't first start with mastering the internal triggers, then we've missed the ball. Because, you know, I don't care what the distraction is, whether it's too much football, too much Facebook, too much news, too much booze, it doesn't matter. All distractions are about a desire to escape discomfort.
Fantastic. So you have told, especially in your book, in your talks a lot, especially in this, especially this sentence, you can't call something a distraction unless you know what is distracting you from. Because the problem is that people mostly, you know, concentrate or focus, if they want to just change something, they change the behavior, they change the thing that they are doing. But they don't change the thing that they are escaping from, and they don't focus on that. Because, for example, one of my clients told me, okay, I didn't do anything, you know, I have done nothing today. I told him, okay, you have done nothing. I mean, you mean you're dead? Because whenever you're alive, you're doing something. You're doing something. So people always, you know, try to do something, but something else pulls them away from that. Could you please explain this and the, you know, the behavior that people especially are doing, human beings are doing, especially about this escaping from the discomfort?
Yeah, so you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it's distracting you from. Means that if you don't decide in advance what you wanted to do with your time, everything is a distraction, right? If you wake up in the morning and you have a blank calendar, what did you get distracted from if you checked Facebook all day? That's fine. It's all a distraction if you didn't plan for anything. So don't blame the news or Facebook or television or whatever for distracting you if you didn't decide in advance what you wanted to do with your time. The only way to know what is distraction is to know what is traction for every minute of your day, which is why we need to do what's called time boxing. We have to plan our time to turn our values into time. You know, when we talk about our values, what are values? Values are attributes of the person we want to become. How would the person you want to become spend their time? And so it's about sitting down and saying, okay, how would the person I want to become spend their time for these three life domains of you, your relationships, and your work? And then what we're going to do is we're going to turn those values into time by putting time for those things in our calendar. And then we just follow the calendar, not a to-do list. To-do lists are terrible. To-do lists will sap your productivity, okay? Instead of using a to-do list, what we have to do is to use what we call a time box calendar, where we decide in advance how we want to spend our time.
Fantastic. You have told something phenomenal, especially about life balance. Because mostly people are talking about work-life balance. And I'm asking, okay, work is excluded from life. How is it possible? And you have told me that there are three, you know, stages, you know, relationship, you, relationship, and also work. How can we make time for tractions and get back the life balance that we always want?
Just decide in advance. This is the difference, is that people complain about this kind of stuff, but they don't ask themselves, well, what does that actually look like? I have no problem with somebody working all day, every day. If that's what you want to do with your time, if that's your values, if that's what the person you want to become does with their time, do it, right? And why not? If you want to start a company or you want to work at a bank and make a lot of money and your values are consistent with working night and day, do it, but do it in advance. Okay, decide that's what you want to do. Don't do it as a sucker because now you work for a company that wants you 24/7 to be connected. Do it with intent, okay? If you want to spend an hour a day with your kids, with your friends, if you want to play video games, I don't care, but do it with intent. Decide how you want to spend your time. It's so simple. We take out our calendar and we decide for every hour of the day, how do we plan to spend our time? So what we're doing is we're taking distractions. Let's say, I don't know, video games or social media, right? You spend too much time on those things. There's nothing wrong with playing video games. What's wrong with it is if you play them when you didn't intend to play them. If you're using them as an escape from reality, that's when you can get into trouble. But if you say, hey, you know what? Every night at 6 p.m. to 6:30 or 7, whatever, I'm going to play video games. Great, do it. But decide it in advance. Put it on your calendar.
Good. You have talked about to-do things a lot. But I haven't heard it from you that you told you have told people about not to do things. Why is that? Maybe I haven't come across with that. Maybe it is.
Well, that's what doing, making time for traction is all about. Because when you put things, this is why I hate to-do lists. Because with to-do lists, everything goes on the to-do list, right? I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to write a novel. I want to learn to speak Chinese. I want to have big muscles. I want. But you can't get those things without input. If you want output, you have to have input. If you go to the baker and you say, I want 100 loaves of bread, okay? The baker will say, okay, I need flour. I need yeast. I need salt. I need sugar. I need the input to make the output. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to knowledge workers, what's our input? Our input is just two things. It's not flour and yeast. It's time and attention. That's it, time and attention. But if you don't plan the time and attention, you're not planning the output, so you're not planning the input, so you're not going to get the output. And so this is why calendars work so much better than to-do lists, because that constraint tells you what not to do. Because now you have to decide. You have all these things you want to do, but you only have, just like every other human being on the face of the earth, I don't care if you're the richest man on earth, if you're, you know, Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, they all have the same amount of time in the day. They have a lot of money, maybe more money than you have, but they don't have more time. They have the exact same amount of time. So by having a time box calendar, it forces you to decide what you will not do based on your values, because we all have the same amount of time every day.
Fantastic. Can I know, especially about the indistractable, if you want to teach me something that you haven't taught anyone up to now, what is it?
Everything that's interesting I put in the book.
Yes.
I want to know
something new.
A well of secrets back here that I pull out. Another secret. I mean, it took me 5 years to write this book because I really wanted it to be research back. Aren't, you know, hey, you know, wish for things to happen in your life. Visualize. That stuff's BS. That doesn't work that way.
Yes.
It doesn't. Good things don't come to you because you think of them. They come because you change your behavior. You do something.
I want to know a big idea.
So I don't keep.
I would like to know a big idea. Okay, maybe you have told others. What is the biggest?
Did you read the book? There's so many big ideas.
So okay. You can really escape from my discomfort. It's your genius. Okay.
I think this idea, I think the biggest takeaway that I can give people is that the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. Okay, let me say that again. The antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. If you're not doing what you said you would do, okay? Do you exercise when you say you will? Do you eat right? Do you devote the time that you want to making yourself more educated, spending time with people that are important? Whatever it is, if you find that you don't do what you say you're going to do, there's only one reason, and that is an impulse control problem. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not deficient. You're not immoral. You're not somehow a less of a person. It's simply you don't have the tools to deal with your impulses. But here's the thing. The antidote to impulsiveness is one thing, forethought. There's no algorithm that the tech companies can make. There's no addictive substances that we can't overcome if we plan ahead. So if you wait till the last minute, you will lose. I promise you. If the cigarette is in your hand, you're going to smoke it.
For sure.
If the chocolate cake is on the fork, you're going to eat it. If you sleep next to your cell phone every night, you're going to pick it up in the morning as soon as you wake up before you even say hello to your loved ones. So the solution, this should blow your mind. Whatever it is you want to do in life, you have to plan ahead. The antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. This is the thing that human beings can do, one of many things that human beings can do better than any other animal on the face of the earth. We can imagine the future. We can predict what is going to happen better than any other animal. And so we should use that ability, that intelligence that we have to help us live the kind of life we want by planning ahead. So what I found in my research, the people who achieve amazing things, the people who have unbelievable success in life, they don't have a lot of self-control. This is a popular myth. They think, oh, you know, that person is very fit because they have a lot of willpower and self-control. No, you know what they have? They don't have a lot of willpower and self-control. They have a system. They plan ahead and they execute on that system, as opposed to, I'll do it whenever I feel like it. No, you do it when the system tells you to do it. That's how you achieve success.
Fantastic. About the impulses, you have told...
Did I blow your mind?
Oh my God, you have just blown... Yeah, it was awesome. You know, I always want something more, you know. I'm sorry about it, but I always... It was awesome. And not a problem. Okay, Nir, about self... You know, you have told me previously about, you know, whenever an impulse comes, just wait for 10 minutes. It has worked for me, you know, a lot. And whenever and whoever I have coached, you know, especially about the temptation process, because Philip Zimbardo, I have talked to him a lot. He has had a lot of studies and research, especially about the temptation process. This 10 minutes, just explain it for my followers.
Sure. So there's many, many techniques in the book. This is just one of many. This isn't the only technique. But the idea here, and by the way, I didn't create this. I can't take credit for it. This comes from acceptance and commitment therapy, which has been around for decades. The idea here is that temptation is not something you necessarily want to always abstain from. That if you tell yourself no, okay, don't do it, many times that can make things worse. That if you know, this is actually a very interesting theory around addiction, around, for example, cigarettes. We're starting to find out that addiction isn't just about nicotine. It's about telling yourself not to smoke. When you ask smokers to stop and actually experience the cigarette, most of them don't actually like it. They say it stinks. It doesn't taste very good. It's not a pleasant experience. So why do they smoke? The theory is that the reason they get addicted, so to speak, is that they tell themselves not to do it, not to smoke. And when they tell themselves no, it's like pulling on a rubber band. You pull, you can't pull anymore. And finally, when you let go, where does the rubber band go? Does it go back to where it started? No, it goes across the room. Okay, why does that happen? It's the same thing when it comes to a temptation, right? When we tell ourselves, don't smoke. Don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke. Finally, when I smoke, it feels so good, right? It feels so good to release ourselves from telling ourselves no. That's what we get addicted to.
Fantastic.
And this is a really big deal because that means that for all kinds of behaviors, whether it's distraction on our phones, whether it's, you know, whatever it is that we're trying to resist, eating that chocolate cake, we have to be smarter than just telling ourselves no, because abstinence can backfire. Now, there's a time and a place for abstinence. I'm not saying it's always ineffective, but we need other techniques as well. So one technique is to not tell yourself no, it's to tell yourself not yet. Mm-hmm. How do you do this? When you have a temptation, okay, when you have something that you say, I don't want to do that, whether it's smoking, eating that piece of chocolate cake, if you're trying to lose weight, or, checking the news when you want to work on that big project, you tell yourself, okay, I can do that thing. I can go check the news. I can go check email. I can have that chocolate cake, but not right now. I can give in 10 minutes. So many times I still use this technique all the time. I'll take out my phone and I'll say, set a timer for 10 minutes and I'll put my phone down. And my job, I have two potential paths I can go down. I can either get back to what I was doing, okay? Get back to writing or whatever it is that I said I was going to do with my time. Or I can sit with that sensation. I can do what we call surfing the urge. So many times I'll sit there and, okay, what am I experiencing? What is this discomfort right now? Okay, I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling uncertain. I'm feeling this is difficult. Okay, how can I reshape that conversation? This is what it feels like to get better at something. So I'm changing the conversation with myself so that I'm learning to surf the urge. And what happens is 9 times out of 10, by the time that timer goes off, you don't feel that urge anymore, right? Because what happens, there's this trick with our emotions that we think that an emotion is going to last forever. When you feel angry, when you feel fearful or uncertain or whatever it might be, you feel like it's going to last forever, but it never does. It's like a wave. It crests and then subsides. So if you can wait out that urge, right, surf the urge like a surfer on a surfboard, 9 times out of 10, by the time that timer goes off, you will have forgotten about it. You'll be right back to the thing you said you were going to do.
Fantastic. Near a certain amount of our time during the day are habits, you know, whatever it is. How do you link these two words, you know, especially if we find, because habits are really valuable. It saves time and energy and everything for us. It's for something for us. And I've always helped people, you know, if I want to help someone, I will help them with habit setting, not goal setting. Because if you have, you know, highly effective habits, you can move forward with whatever you want. First of all, one personal question, the other one, the general question. One personal question, how many percentage of your days are habits? I don't know what are they, you know, and because you put them in, for example, in your timetable and whatever it is, but after a while, it's a habit and it saves energy.
Yes and no. Yes and no.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We have to be careful around habits. And I wrote an article about this. I'm happy to send it to you about how I think we've overdone it on habits, to be honest. I think the community, you know, everybody's read a book about habits. And I think we've reached peak habit. And I think the problem is that people don't know what habits really are. That habits today, when someone sees a book about habits, they buy the book and they say, I want to adopt a habit. What they are really saying is that I want the hard thing that I don't feel like doing to be effortless. That's what they're saying. I want to have written a novel. I don't really want to write it. I want to have had worked out. I don't really want to go to the gym. I want to have had eaten healthy, but I don't really want to right now, right? They want to offload the difficult things to a habit, and somehow this miracle habit will do the hard stuff for them. But that's not a habit. What is the definition of a habit? What's the definition of a habit? The definition of a habit is the impulse to do a behavior with little or no conscious thought. Mm-hmm. Far too many behaviors that people say they want to turn into a habit will never meet that definition. If you go to the gym and you want to build muscle or lose weight, if you want to get better at a skill, that cannot be a habit. If you want to get better, if you know what could be a habit is I want to take a walk. A walk is something you can do with little or no conscious thought, but you don't want to get better at walking. If you want to beat your time as a runner, let's say you're a runner or a cyclist or whatever kind of athlete, you want to get faster. Let me tell you, there's nothing done with little or no conscious thought about that type of activity. You know, I run several times a week. If I'm trying to beat my time, that's not habitual. I am fully present in pain, suffering with all my mind. It's hard. And the only way to get better is to embrace the suck, right? That's what we call it. That's what the Marines call it. You have to embrace the fact that it's going to hurt. That's how we get better at stuff. The same with writing. People say, oh, I want to get into the habit of writing. Well, unless you're writing without conscious thought, it's not going to become a habit. So stop calling it a habit. Instead, call it a routine. A routine is a series of behaviors frequently repeated, right? So every habit has to start as a routine. But not every routine will become a habit. And you say, well, what's the big deal, Nir? It's just semantics. People want to call it habits, let them call it habits. No. The reason why we can't call it a habit is because here's what happens. We tell people this mumbo jumbo of, oh, just take any behavior and, you know, follow this 3-part model and you can turn it into a habit. But you can't. Yeah. And you won't. So what do people do? Do they blame the author who wrote the book? No. Yep. You know what they do? They blame themselves. I follow this routine. You know, I follow this 3-part model I read about in a book, and I still hate running. I still hate exercise. I still hate writing. Why? It's not effortless. You know what? I must be messed up. I must not have enough self-control. I must be doing it wrong. And they blame themselves and they quit. That's a tragedy. So we need to get off these habits and call them what they really are. They are routines. Some routines can become habits. Some routines will never become habits, but that's okay. Don't have the expectation that something done with a lot of conscious thought, something that is difficult to do, will ever become a habit. Keep it as a routine and don't expect it to become effortless. That's totally fine. So it's very important that we differentiate between a routine and a habit.
Fantastic. It was really, you know, right now my mind is blown. Okay.
Good.
Yeah.
You just had to ask the right question, right?
Yeah. Especially, we are living in the era of self-sabotaging behaviors. And especially the thing that you are telling me, you know, especially blaming, complaining, and we are good self-sabotagers of ourselves, you know, whatever we do. And of course, the thing that you are mentioning that, yes, we don't blame the writer, just we blame ourselves. Okay, maybe there is something wrong with me, not anyone else. And for sure, it is routines. So what's your routines?
Oh, okay. So I have a lot of routines. I don't have that many habits. I have a few, but I have many more routines because I want to get better at what I'm doing. I want to be a better writer. I want to be a better father. I want to be a better husband. I want to be a better athlete. And so that requires a lot of conscious thought. So many of these things are not habitual. So my day, every day is pretty similar, right? I wake up around 7:00. I have breakfast with my family. At 8:00, I start my work. I do 2 hours of writing a day. Then I check emails. Then I have lunch with my family. And then I have the rest of the afternoon, a few days a week or 2 days a week, I have with my daughter. And then the rest of the days of the week, I have meetings and phone calls and interviews and things like that. So it's pretty routinized.
Fantastic. Yes, we have developed a sort of application. I will send you the link. It is on iOS and Android both, especially about daily routines. We have, you know, just 4 parts of a day, especially in time coach idea, you know, morning routines, daily routines, night routines, and sleep routines, whatever it is. And yeah, we mainly focus on first hour of a day and the last hour of a day. You know, these 2 times, you know, are really, really great that are filled with distraction, you know, especially, yeah, you know, I hate to say that, but, you know, mostly people are, you know, addicted to screens, especially at night, you know, before going to bed, yeah, and it will destroy their, you know, their sleep routines and everything. Yeah. So everything is,
yeah, you know, we call that too tired to go to bed. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
We've all felt it. You know that feeling. I'm so tired. I can't go to bed. I'm going to keep scrolling here.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And especially whenever you wake up, you know, sometimes, you know, my clients ask me, Iman, whenever I wake up, I'm tired. And I said, okay, what have you done? You were sleeping. And,
yeah,
and this, you know, affect all aspects of our lives, you know, last hour, yeah, of the day, first hour and everything. And especially sleeping, I can call it habits, you know, sleep habits. I cannot call it sleep routines, but it is sleep habits that people are somehow killing it. And they don't focus on it.
It's very true. You know, the reason you wake up tired is most of the time because you didn't get to bed on time.
Yeah.
Right. So many times it's so funny. I talk to so many parents with the same problem of, oh, I have trouble getting started in the morning. I'm so tired. And they, you know, I said, what advice do you give your kid every night about getting to bed? Does your child have a bedtime? Of course my child has a bedtime. I'd be a negligent parent if I didn't tell my child when to go to bed. I said, well, do you have a bedtime? No, I'm a grown-up. Why do I need a bedtime? Because you don't want to be a hypocrite? Do you think that somehow children need sleep and you don't? No, we all need a bedtime. And it's not even questionable anymore. We know we need quality sleep. It's not, I mean, you don't need to, you know, we don't need to talk about this because it's common knowledge. Everybody knows you need quality sleep. But if we don't put that in our schedule, you know, and so this was a big problem that I had in my own life. My wife and I, we've been married for almost 19 years now. And a few years ago, before I wrote Indistractable, we were getting to bed every night later and later. So not only did our sleep suffer, our sex life suffered, right? We didn't have time to be intimate anymore because I was going to bed and I was caressing my phone and she was playing with her iPad and we had no time to be together. And so what did we do? We followed the indistractable model. We understood the four steps. One of the four, the fourth step is about preventing distraction with pacts. So what did we do? We went to the hardware store and we got ourselves a $5 outlet timer. And this outlet timer, anything you plug into it will turn on or off at any time of day or night. What do we plug into it? Our internet router. Mm. So every night at 10 p.m., our internet shuts off automatically. Okay. So could I turn it back on? Of course I could turn it back on, right? But now I'd have to go under my desk. I'd have to unplug it, replug it. It's a lot of effort. It's a lot of work to do something that I told myself I wouldn't do. And so that bit of effort reminds me, oh, I don't want to do that bit of mindless behavior. It inserts a bit of mindfulness in this otherwise mindless behavior. And so it's very, very effective. So that's the fourth step, that pact we make with ourselves. Ironically enough, using tools and technologies to prevent us from getting distracted by technology.
And also you have mixed it with designing for lazy people. Fantastic. Okay, great. Nir, it was a really great pleasure. Whenever I talk to you for an hour, less than an hour, it's like, you know, passing a term of a university. Wow. In time, because it's really an awesome, you know, it's an honor for me, you know, to be able to talk to you as a really great teacher for me and for the people who are looking forward to, you know, listen to your words, because it's really, you know, scientific, it's clear, it's, you know, it's really, you know, understandable, you know, the things that you are saying, and it's really great. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart, and I hope I can, you know, follow you forever, and whenever you are saying it's a really great learning opportunity for me to go ahead and look forward to do it. By the way, thank you for your time. If you want to add something, you know, the last word, just say it, and make me happy.
Well, I appreciate it, Iman. Thank you so much for having me. It's a big honor for you to take the time with me and for the kind words. And for anyone out there, if you go to my website at nirandfar.com, Nir is spelled like my first name, N-I-R. There's a free workbook, an 80-page workbook that we couldn't fit into the final edition of the book. So we're happy to make it available for free. It's at nearandfar.com, and you can get that 80-page workbook there. And the book, again, is called Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. And thank you so much again for having me on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have fun. All right. And bye-bye.